Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Honestly, you run out of things to say. Home sales are down, but you knew that. Builders say they're giving up on making a profit at all this year, and subprime mortgages are wreaking all kinds of havoc. Although, there is always this. The fallout from the housing slump might be worse than we thought. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years, with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday. Today's the 27th of March. In a way, you almost wish the market gods would let us have it once and for all. As it stands, the news about real estate's more like a steady drip, drip, drip than a single big thing. And we've been over it with you before. In a nutshell, home buyers aren't buying, so prices are falling. And the number of houses on the market keeps on rising. Today, some analysts said publicly what others have been thinking, that there's got to be a wider economic impact before the slump is over. Marketplace's Amy Scott takes it from there.
It may seem like all you hear about the housing market these days is doom and gloom, but in a note to clients, strategists at Morgan Stanley suggest people aren't worried enough. They warn that the rise in delinquencies and foreclosures on subprime loans has knocked out the cornerstone of the U.S. housing market. Christopher Thornburg is a forecaster with Beacon Economics. He says declining wealth from real estate could slow down the all-important consumer economy, and that could trigger a recession.
People are realizing their home isn't this unlimited source of new wealth. They now have to get their books back into order, and that implies a big consumer shock.
On Wall Street, home builders took a hit after Lennar Corporation said its profits fell 73% in the first quarter. Standard & Poor's announced its home price index for 10 metropolitan areas hit its lowest level in more than a decade. Economist Joel Naroff says prices need to drop more. He says many builders have brought their prices down, but owners of existing homes are still holding out for more than they can get.
I call this the seller's denial segment of the housing cycle, where sellers do see that they're having trouble selling their homes, but they're just not willing to drop the price enough where those homes will actually be bid on.
Subprime buyers helped inflate home prices. With access to cheap loans, borrowers could buy at prices they otherwise couldn't afford. With those buyers out of the picture, Naroff says affordability is much more important. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The chairman of the Federal Reserve might have something to say about all the housing news tomorrow. Ben Bernanke scheduled for some quality time with the Congressional Joint Economic Committee about mid-morning or so. You've heard of the no-fly list, the one used by airlines and airport security to keep suspected terrorists from flying with the rest of us? A new report out today focuses on the no-buy list. It's a government document meant to keep terrorists from buying stuff here in the U.S. But businesses using that list are denying services to innocent people. And Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio there's not much they can do about it.
Okay, consider this scenario. You've got a good job, make enough money, but for some reason no one will tell you about. 10 lending institutions have refused to give you a mortgage. That's what happened to Tom Kubani. He finally figured out that all the banks thought he was a terrorist.
I went and got my paperwork, and it showed my middle name was an alias for the son of Saddam Hussein.
His middle name was a partial match with one that showed up on the Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, list. It's supposed to identify suspected terrorists that companies can't sell to. But a new report from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights documents a dozen cases of innocent people refused services because of incorrect matches with this list. Shireen Sinar wrote the report. She says businesses use the list without any government standards for training or civil rights compliance.
People are being told that as a result of having a particular ethnic name, they're not able to do business with someone.
The OFAC list has been around for years, but an executive order signed by President Bush post 9/11 expanded its use. Attorney Michael Frumkin at the University of Miami says businesses could be in big trouble if they don't use it.
They want to play by the rules. But when these rules were introduced, I don't think anybody was thinking more than the banking system.
While the list is available online, there's no process in place to get off of it. The Lawyers Committee wants safeguards put in place that will protect innocent people from ending up on the list. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The Senate debated the Iraq War funding bill today. There could be a vote on the $122 billion package sometime tomorrow, setting the stage for a promised presidential veto. Democrats over in the House, meanwhile, turned to trade. They're trying to force the White House to consider environmental, labor, and health issues when the president makes deals. Ways and Means Committee Chairman Charlie Rangel introduced the Democratic plan today that could make it tougher for the administration to get its trade agenda back on track. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more now from the Marketplace America's desk at WLRN.
Democrats have long pushed to include worker protections in U.S. trade deals. Today, they're adding safeguards against logging and access to low-cost generic drugs to the list.
These issues have kind of come out of left field, literally.
That's Bruce Stokes, a columnist with the National Journal. He says by adding these new requirements, Democrats could derail Bush's trade agenda that could leave pending deals with Panama, Peru, and Colombia dead in the water.
This administration has no time left, no political energy left, and no credibility left to actually push through any more of these. So whatever happens now, it merely is teeing things up or not teeing things up for the next administration.
Bush faces a deadline this Saturday on the three Latin American trade deals. He needs to give Congress 90-day notice under fast-track authority, which expires by the end of June. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Investors never really had a chance today after the housing news and a report on sinking consumer confidence. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Walt Disney Company has been around for 83 years. In that time, it's only had six CEOs. The name you probably know best is Michael Eisner. He had the top job for 20 years. Profitable ones, but tumultuous ones, too. Eisner stepped down in the fall of 2005, and a guy named Bob Iger took over.
The boss will see you now.
Iger spent 30 years at ABC Television. He was the president of the network when Disney bought it back in 1996. And 4 years later, he became president of the parent company. Disney seems to have changed gears in the year and a half since Iger moved a rung up the corporate ladder. And we talked about that last week on the Disney lot in Burbank. You made a couple of moves right off the bat that generated a lot of attention, a lot of interest, and made people say, look at Disney and Iger and what he's doing. And I'm talking about the deal you made to get your programming on the iPod, and the fact that you now stream online some of your most valuable properties. Did you pick up the phone one day and call Steve Jobs over at Apple and say, listen, Steve, I have a great idea?
No, he actually called me months and months before, and he wanted to talk about creating a television-like side to iTunes. And coincidentally, I said to him, well, we had been thinking about possibly creating the same thing. And he said, well, let's talk. And one thing led to another, including my becoming CEO and the discussion on Pixar, which was actually totally unrelated. But when I was named CEO-elect, so to speak, Steve and I talked a lot about the future of the relationship between Pixar and Disney, and we got to know each other better. And that actually helped advance the dialogue on the Apple side.
Do you think you've put Disney in the early adopter category of people who are acknowledging the consumer power that exists in the marketplace today?
Disney acknowledges the consumer power in the marketplace today. Where that puts us in terms of the rest of the world or the industry, I'm less concerned. It was a real priority of ours to focus on the consumer. What digital technology has done, it's created a huge power shift from the creator and the distributor, the old world, to the consumer, the new world. And while the creator and the distributor still have ample say in how things are made and how they're distributed, the fact is that the end user, the consumer, has a lot more say than ever before, a lot more authority. And if you ignore that change or you ignore the consumer, you get a result like the music industry, which is that a lot of content lost value because of the way the consumer was accessing it. And entities emerged, in this case, really iTunes and Apple, where value actually shifted from the creator and the distributor to a completely new entity.
Right, but you're at a touchy space now where you're moving toward distribution on, just as an example, iTunes. People pay $1.99 a pop to get Desperate Housewives, right? But
not a bad deal.
Not a bad deal, but a single night broadcast of Desperate Housewives probably gets way more revenue for you than you're ever going to get at $1.99 a pop from 1.5 million downloads.
Correct.
And how do you, where's that balance, right?
Well, if you, since you use Desperate Housewives as an example.
Not that I watch.
A successful TV series will produce between 22 and 25 episodes each season. And the committed or the avid viewer of that series in a given year will probably watch somewhere in the neighborhood of a third of all those episodes because of other choices, lifestyle-wise, meaning you're busy, you've got other obligations, or other choices in terms of consuming media. And if we could figure out ways, which we are starting to do, thanks again to digital technology, to engage these people more often, to get them to consume more, then we actually will grow our business instead of in any way decreasing or diminishing our business. So a lot of these initiatives are actually designed to create incremental consumption, to give people who may not have a chance to watch as many of these programs as they once did to watch more, instead of to shift their viewing from the, I'll call it the initial airing that creates the most value on ABC to a secondary consumption form that may create less value.
What do you do to unwind? Are you one of those guys who plops himself in front of the TiVo at Thursday at 9 o'clock? Or do you get do you get those in advance so that, you know,
Grey's
you can watch it when you
on
want?
Thursdays at
I know.
9. I have access to getting a lot of product in advance. So much of it that it's almost impossible to watch everything, and certainly impossible to watch everything in advance. So I tend to varying degrees to watch things as they occur. Grey's Anatomy is one that my wife and I particularly enjoy watching together, to the point where if we're not in the same town when it airs, we figure out a way to get a copy of it, or we stream it on ABC.com or watch it on iTunes and like to watch it together. So last night's a good example. We watched Grey's Anatomy from last Thursday night, last night.
So you take care to avoid all the spoilers, right?
Yes, exactly. I don't ask questions. Please don't tell me I'm going to watch.
Bob Iger is the president and CEO of the Walt Disney Company. Mr. Iger, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much.
You can hear more of what the Disney CEO had to say about the Pixar acquisition, the balance between business and creativity, and how much Disney television his own kids get to watch. It's on our website, marketplace.org. And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 71 points, 0.5%, to close at 12,397. The NASDAQ dipped 18 points, almost 0.75%, to finish at 2437. The S&P 500 declined 8 points, more than 0.6% there, to end at 1428. More bad news on home prices and consumer confidence weighed down the markets. Lennar, the nation's third largest home builder, dipped nearly 0.1%. Earlier in the day, it had announced a 73% decline in first quarter profits. D.R. Horton, one of the country's top housing construction companies, tumbled more than 0.33%. As builders bombed, Daimler Chrysler rolled forward. Shares in America's biggest maker of heavy trucks drove up 1.8%. The Detroit News is reporting the company could receive the first round of bids on its U.S.-based Chrysler unit within days now. Overseas, markets were, well, let's call them mixed. Back home, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for February. A Senate committee convenes a hearing on the next generation of human spaceflight. And the media has been there, VIPs have done it, and even astronaut Buzz Aldrin has taken the first steps out onto the glass bridge of the Grand Canyon. The skywalk opens tomorrow to the public. For $25, you can stand 4,000 feet above the canyon floor, if you can stomach it. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Oil prices fell today, down 0.8%. A barrel of light sweet crude was running about 46.8 euros at the close. Yes, euros, not dollars. That's the preferred method of payment in Tehran. In just the latest sign of geopolitical tensions, Iran's asking customers to pay for its most valuable export in euros, and some of them have already started, one Chinese state-run company in particular. And Japan, which buys 25% of Iran's production, said it's ready to switch too. We asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler to sort out what it might mean if traders start pulling out the euros to pay for crude. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how's it going?
Help us understand this for a second. What difference really does it make if oil is denominated in euros rather than dollars, as it has been forever?
Well, short term, probably nothing. Even if all Iran's trade partners paid exclusively in euros, economists tell me that it would have relatively little impact on the value of the dollar. In fact, in the last year or so, Russia has shifted away from using dollars and now prefers to get paid in euros, and that's had very little impact on the dollar. Economists say it doesn't matter what currency you use to pay for things. What matters is the currency that you don't exchange but hold as a security.
All right, we'll leave it to the economists to make it difficult to understand. What does that mean when they start talking about foreign currency reserves and people holding on to the dollar like that?
Well, traditionally, the dollar has been seen as a safe currency. It's stable. It's where you go in times of trouble. And that's been good for the U.S. economy. It gives us more control over the global economy. It boosts our government coffers because we can mint money for much less than it costs to sell it to other countries. And in times of crisis, other folks come here, and that helps boost our economy.
All right, but Jeff, if I look at my little Reuters terminal here, it's going to tell me that the dollar's been having a really tough time against the Japanese yen the past couple of months, and a really tough time against the euro as well.
Well, there's some dark clouds out there. The trade deficit, the housing slump, the weakening economy. There are lots of reasons to think that the dollar is going to look less attractive in the years to come.
Okay, so let's flip this on its head and assume for, you know, Secretary Paulson's sake, the worst case, that is to say, people stop using the dollar to pay for oil and they start using euros. What's that going to mean for the dollar and then for the larger economy?
Well, it could potentially be a good thing. If the world shifted over hypothetically to using euros, that would lower the value of the dollar, increasing our exports, which would help us get our trade deficit in line.
China, of course, is the country that has the biggest trade surplus with us. They have a huge surplus. We have a deficit. They also have trillions of dollars sitting in their central bank. How's this going to factor into that equation?
Well, the biggest fear is that the dollar will become unattractive to the Chinese, who will dump it. But that is very unlikely to happen because they'd be shooting themselves in the foot. They own basically most of our debts. So if they were to undermine the value of that, they would be undermining the value of their own reserves.
All right. Marketplace of Jeff Tyler and the vagaries of the oil market and the dollar as the global currency. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Kai.
Here's an oldie but a goodie from the pollution files, smog. It doesn't get much attention anymore with all the focus on global warming, but many scientists are urging the White House to toughen up U.S. smog standards. They say the government's not doing enough to protect public health, especially children and the elderly who are most vulnerable to respiratory problems. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports now on growing concern over our dirty skies and how ethanol has become part of the search for a solution.
It's mid-morning on a hill high above the intersection of two busy freeways in Diamond Bar, California. That's the easternmost edge of Los Angeles County, where the traffic grows heavier every year. In the distance, you can see the snow-capped peaks of the San Gabriel Mountains. Well, sort of.
Mount Wilson, We can't really see through the haze this morning.
Sam Atwood works for the biggest air pollution district in the country.
And even further off in the distance, obscured by the haze, would be Mount San Gorgonio, the tallest mountain in Southern California.
When that haze burns off by noontime, what's left is smog. And here at the South Coast Air Quality Management District, workers see plenty of it. Every day, more than 11 million cars and trucks clog the roads in their region, emitting the pollution that tinges the skies with a yellow-brown haze.
Southern California has had the stigma of being the smog capital of the nation for decades, and frankly, that's a title we'd like to lose.
But Southern Californians aren't the only ones breathing unhealthy air. Nearly 160 million Americans live in cities and now suburbs where smog levels exceed the legal limit. Now, scientists at the Environmental Protection Agency are recommending even stricter limits on ground-level ozone, the main ingredient in smog. U.S. ozone standards haven't changed since 1997, and critics say it's long overdue. Lydia Wegman directs the EPA's Health and Environmental Effects Division.
What the staff did is look at the science that has come out since 1997, as well as science before 1997, and we have dozens of new studies that have come out, and the staff concluded that the current standard is not sufficiently protective of public health.
Wegman's staff ended up recommending smog limits of anywhere from a little below 0.080 to 0.060 parts per million. Now, that's Greek to most of us, and it's hard to quantify the benefits. But Janice Nolan at the American Lung Association says if the nation's smog zones actually met those standards, the improvement will first be seen in doctors' offices and emergency rooms.
There is no question that if EPA sets a standard that provides the kind of safety levels that we're talking about, lives can be saved.
If ozone levels in New York City met the strictest standard under recommendation, Nolan estimates the Big Apple would see 40% fewer hospital admissions for asthma. She notes that when Atlanta restricted traffic during the Olympics, ozone levels dropped dramatically. So did asthma attacks. Recent studies link dirty air to lung damage, heart disease, and shorter lifespans. And kids living near busy highways are especially vulnerable.
For the rest of their lives, they are at greater risk of all of the problems that come from lung diseases in the future. So it has enormous and widespread impacts.
EPA Administrator Stephen Johnson will decide in June whether to change U.S. smog standards. Johnson has rejected the advice of science advisors before, and EPA has been sued as a result. Meanwhile, scientists are debating how President Bush's push for more ethanol will affect smog levels. Ethanol actually reduces carbon monoxide, but increases evaporative emissions of another key pollutant. Clean air advocates are calling for more research. In Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Delta Airlines announced today it expects to get out from under bankruptcy protection by the end of April. It's promising more value for shareholders and better customer service. That's good news for almost anybody who flies, and even better news for business travelers. Some of them have to cope with the hassles of getting to and from their flights a couple of times a week. The free market, though, has come up with an alternative to that chaos, and Jason Parr checked it out.
Airline travel can be trying. That's no secret. But really, it's not the flying with the airline that's usually the tough part. It's the getting to, from, and through the airport that causes the most headaches. With traffic, check-in, and security, it can take several hours to make it to your gate, even if it's just the short distance from Wall Street to John F. Kennedy Airport in New York. But if you're willing to pay, you can float over most of those headaches.
So right now we are at 1,000 feet over Long Island, just crossed over from Manhattan.
That's helicopter pilot Christine Catney.
Right up ahead of us, you can see Kennedy Airport, just about 9 miles away.
Catney works for U.S. Helicopters, a scheduled airline that flies passengers from Manhattan to JFK. And at more than 150 miles an hour, that trip only takes about 8 minutes, and it costs $169 one way. It's the nation's only scheduled helicopter airline and is less than a year old. It operates flights from two heliports in Manhattan to both JFK and Newark Airport in New Jersey. Jerry Murphy is the president and CEO. A veteran of the airline industry, he knew the hassles of travel firsthand and says the business model was honed over years of research, talking with the people who fly the most.
Our customer base is the business traveler. Not that we're not interested in leisure travel, but a business traveler is our customer. To the business traveler, if they could spend 2 hours more time in the office, either cleaning up work or conducting new business or new sales that they could possibly make, it gives them back their time.
Sitting at the Wall Street heliport is one of those business travelers. Michael Starkenberg works in venture capital and travels a lot. He's on his way back home to L.A. and says the time savings is one thing, but so is the hassle. Passengers on the helicopter pass through security at the heliport, where there are no lines, and are dropped off at a terminal and walk straight to their gate. Starkenberg enjoys the experience so much, he hopes the service expands.
In L.A., there's a helicopter pad at Terminal 4 right in the middle of LAX, and I live in Orange County, which is an hour away. If I could find somebody who would put me in that terminal helicopter, I'd do it in a second. You know, for the same dollar per minute savings, I'd do it in a second.
U.S. Helicopter says they do have plans to expand to other cities around the country, though they're not saying which ones just yet. The market is limited to places where the time savings can be enough to justify the price, according to airline analyst Richard Abelafia. He says because helicopters are so expensive to operate, they're unlikely to be used by anybody other than high-end travelers in congested cities.
Helicopter travel costs are relatively astronomical. If a business jet is, say, 3 or 4 times commercial scheduled service first class, then a helicopter service is even more than that, several times that. So ultimately, it's only going to be used for a very small market over very small areas.
Right now, many of the flights on the 8-passenger helicopters aren't exactly full. But even with a market limited to the travel elite, traffic isn't getting any better in most places, and lines at the airport don't seem to be shrinking. U.S. Helicopter hopes this continuing inconvenience will push more customers into their cabins. From New York, I'm Jason Parr for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note from the Marketplace desk of Now We've Seen Everything. Drug runners are getting tax breaks in the Netherlands, or at least one very lucky Dutchman is. According to newspaper reports over there, a local court ruled a fisherman and convicted drug smuggler could write off the cost of buying and shipping hashish from his tax return, but only because he was transporting the drugs, not actually selling them. The fisherman was hit with a $4.4 million tax bill. The deductions cut that by half, although the National Tax Department does say it's going to appeal. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 71 points, more than 0.5% there. The Nasdaq lost 18 points, about 0.75%. The S&P 500 down 8 points. That is 0.6%. Thanks to Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, high-interest loans aren't just for houses.
One very prevalent form are subprime credit cards. Another very common kind is subprime car financing. Title loans, people borrowing money on their car titles. A lot of payday lending.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.